It is vitally important to remember that throughout the early 20th century, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party were incredibly ideologically diverse. I think people look back from our present day when the Republicans are on the right and Democrats are on the left and assume that it's always been that way. It's simply not true. You can look back at any point in time in here and you can see both parties essentially wrestling with what they had been. If you look back to the 19th century, it's a little clearer. The Democrats are largely the conservative party, especially on issues of race and the size of government. Republicans are the much more liberal activist party. But over the course of the early 20th century, both camps start to change. The Democrats start to find a lot more in terms of liberal and moderate in the North. The Republicans start to have more and more conservatives, largely rooted out west. So the parties are becoming much more muddled on issues of race. African-American voters had, since the Civil War, since the 15th Amendment, had been largely concentrated in the Republican Party. That was still seen by them as the party of Lincoln. And they hung to that pretty hard and fast. It's not until the New Deal that they start to switch in massive numbers. In the 1932 election, they are one of the last constituencies to stand by Hoover, as he's repudiated by the entire country. They still feel loyal to the Republican Party. But in 1936, they switch over to the Democrats in large numbers. Now, importantly, they do this not because the Democrats are committed to any stance on civil rights. The Democrats at this time still had large numbers of Southern Democrats who were the agents of Jim Crow in their midst, and there was any effort at the national level to move the party to civil rights was met with fierce opposition from them. And so as Ira Katz Nelson and several other historians have shown in their work, the Southern Democrats basically held the party hostage on the issue of civil rights. They threatened to bring everything to a halt. They have a six-week filibuster at one point with an anti-lynching bill in front of the Senate. They grind everything to the halt. And in the Depression, Roosevelt rationalizes that he can't afford to move on civil rights if he's going to get the country on its feet and out of the Depression. Fast forward a little bit to 1948, and Harry Truman is really the pivot point here. Truman reacts to stories of black veterans coming home from the Second World War and being brutalized, lynched, assaulted in the South. There's a story of a Sergeant Isaac Woodard who is taken off a bus in a town in South Carolina and beaten so badly by local cops that they use their billy clips to gouge his eyes out, to blind him. And he's beaten so bad that he doesn't know who he is for 3 weeks. He languishes in this jail where he's under arrest for resisting arrest. his family finds him. These stories enrage Truman. And Truman is someone who'd grown up in Missouri, a fairly, racist, segregated society. But this speaks to a certain kind of sense of dissonance. So he appoints this Presidential Commission on Civil Rights. And they meet in 46 and 47, and they issue a report. And at the time, a lot of people think this is just kind of typical presidential commissions. We're going to issue a report. We've studied it. Not much is going to be done. Truman leans into it. And to everyone's surprise, Truman advocates for all of these proposals. And it's a fairly, not just liberal, almost radical proposals on civil rights in this period. And he recommends that that these all get pushed through and passed by Congress. This is what prompts the Dixiecrat split. Is in the 1948 convention, Truman not only leans into this, but Hubert Humphrey gives a famous speech. He's then the mayor of Minneapolis, gives a famous speech where he says basically, he's got a quote in there, I'm going to butcher it, but that it's come time for the Democratic Party to step out of the shadow of states' rights and into the bright sunshine of human rights. So basically he calls on the party to reject its old roots in the segregationist South and instead embrace civil rights as a cause. This is what fractures the Democratic Party in this period. So several delegations from the South literally storm out of the convention. They gather for the States' Rights Democratic Party, known as the Dixiecrats, at their own convention in Birmingham, and they nominate Governor Strom Thurmond of South Carolina to be the champion. And Thurmond was an outspoken opponent of civil rights, an ardent defender of segregation. His speeches from the time are kind of laden with all the Jim Crow tropes you would expect. So that shows the party is starting to be at war with itself. The Dixiecrats lose bad in 48. The only states they win are the ones where actually local allies push Truman off the ballot. And so if you vote for the Democrat, you vote for Strom Thurmond. Those are the four states they win. But they lose bad, and they wind up coming back to the Democratic Party. But the warning signs are there, and the balance within the party has started to shift. Now, it doesn't move much in the 50s because both parties really take a hands-off role, a hands-off approach to civil rights. Dwight Eisenhower doesn't want anything to do with it. He gets credit after the fact for appointing Earl Warren to the Supreme Court and helping move the Brown decision further. But Eisenhower hated the decision. After Brown, he says appointing Warren was the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. He never comes out. His aides, he has a liberal attorney general. They encourage him to come out and say something on behalf of this Brown decision. This is the law of the land. We've got to comply with it. He doesn't want anything to do with it because he wants to win over the votes of white Southerners. He thinks he's got a shot there. He had made some inroads in 52. He hopes to do the same in 56. The Democrats are no better. Adlai Stevenson is the nominee in 52 and 56, runs against Eisenhower both times. And he, too, doesn't want to rock the boat too much. And he's fine with the status quo. And so you see neither party really making a move for the black vote, making a move on civil rights, because they largely are still trying to appeal to white Southerners. They see them as this key swing block. Then you get up to Kennedy, and Kennedy has kind of the same attitude. Kennedy had made bold promises on the campaign. He said he would end housing discrimination in federal projects with a stroke of a pen. He doesn't for a year or so, to the point where civil rights leaders they start an Ink for Jack campaign where they have people mail him pens. You know, if you need a pen, here you go. But it's really not until Birmingham and those images of high school and elementary school children being attacked with German shepherds and high-power water cannons, that really turns Kennedy around on the issue. And he comes to realize that they've got to do something. And so Kennedy starts this process, really, of kind of picking up that thread that Truman had begun, but really pushing it forward. And so he calls for, in June 1963, what becomes the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He is assassinated, of course, in November. And everyone thinks that Lyndon Johnson, a Texan, is going to soft-pedal this. But Johnson actually makes the law even tougher. He pushes for its public accommodations measures and its voting measures to be even tougher than they'd been before. The Democrats get this bill through the House. They require some support from some Republicans to overcome the opposition of Southern Democrats. But it's a Democratic bill by a Democratic president pushed through by Democratic leaders. And importantly, one of the people who votes against the bill is Barry Goldwater. And Goldwater himself wasn't a racist. But Goldwater was very much a libertarian and thought that the federal government should have no role in enforcing civil rights, in desegregating schools, in desegregating public spaces, that this needed to happen through the private wills of business. Well, those nuances are lost in the public. All the public sees, especially in the white South, is that Lyndon Johnson is for the civil rights bill, and Barry Goldwater is against it. And so that leads large numbers of white Southerners, Trent Lott has a famous line, that was the moment we all decided maybe we were Republicans. That leads lots of white Southerners to think about voting for the Republican Party for the first time. You know, they no longer thought of it as the party of Lincoln. They thought of it as the presidential nominee who voted against the Civil Rights Act. And this is really apparent in public polling at the time. Again, if you look at polls in 1962, they asked which party is more likely to see to it that Negroes receive fair treatment in housing. The party, it's basically a split vote. Nobody can really, there's no favorite here. Which party is more likely to pursue school integration? Again, the same thing, a split vote. A couple years later, they do this poll, and it's overwhelming support for the Democratic Party. It's clear which party is now pushing for civil rights. I think only like 7% picks the Republicans at this time. So that's the shadow that Goldwater cast. And so from that moment on, the parties really start to shift. And so from 64 on, the Democratic Party really is seen more and more by the public and by its members as the party committed to civil rights. The Republican Party, from Goldwater and Nixon on, is seen as the party that is less interested in that. You can see it in, again, you look at their platforms. The Republican Party platform of 1960, when Nixon runs, and Nixon is more liberal than Eisenhower on civil rights of this period, it's got long, long sections on civil rights. I mean, it goes into detail about voting and all these other different areas. It really does lay out an agenda. In 64, they've got about three sentences.
Yeah.
In 1968, there is not a mention of civil rights in the entire platform.
Wow.
Instead, it's all about law and order, which is the code term that George Wallace had used for basically putting the brakes on this. So you can really see the transformation if you look at the platforms, if you look at public polling, if you look at the speeches here. Now, this switch doesn't happen immediately. It's not that every Southern Democrat gets up and walks out of the party and becomes a Republican. Many stay in there for their life. In fact, if you look at congressmen and senators, all the old Dixiecrats, most of them stay Democrats, and they do so for one key reason. That was where all their power came from.
Interesting.
This is a period in which congressional chairs have an incredible amount of power. This is before the Watergate reforms. These are amazing jobs to have.
Right.
And you get these jobs by having seniority in the majority party. The Democrats are still in this period, have about a 2-to-1 majority in Congress. It seems they're always going to be the majority. Why would you take a job with a minority party, especially if you take that job and you have to start over your seniority clock from scratch? Strom Thurmond, when he switches in 1964, cuts a very sweet deal with the Republicans. They let him keep all the years of seniority he had racked up as a Democrat, and they let him count as a Republican. There's a move to try to get this to apply to other Southern Democrats who switch. William F. Buckley talks about this in 1970, that there's a move afoot to lure all these other Dixiecrats across. The rest of the Republicans don't want this. They don't want these Johnny-come-latelys to come over and,
right.
and kind of jump the queue ahead of the line the time they've done, especially after they've done it in the minority. So they really push back against this, and nothing happens. So you have these old Dixiecrats stay in the Democratic Party largely until they die. But what they do is they instruct the new generation coming up behind them that if you're going to start a political career, if you're going to start that seniority clock, the Republican Party is the place to do it. Because we agree with them on all these other issues. We're kind of naturally conservatives on against unions, against welfare legislation, against things like that. If they're now the conservative party on civil rights too, all the better. So to give one example, William Colmer, who was, I think he was the head of House Ways and Means, an incredibly important committee, from Mississippi, a really powerful Dixiecrat, stays in the Democratic Party until he retires in 72. And he tells his young aide, Trent Lott, that he's going to handpick him to succeed him. But he tells Lott to run as a Republican.
Oh, interesting.
And you see that kind of switch happen all over the South. But again, it happens in fits and starts. It happens when one of these guys dies, when they retire, and they get someone to, you know, to kind of run in their place. And so you see that's the way the change happens. It's not in 1964, suddenly, you know, the party loses all the Southern Democrats and they all move over to the Republican Party. It happens in fits and starts over a period of not just years, but decades. It's not really until the early 90s that you really see the House of Southern Democrats, the conservatives, really have shifted over to the Republican Party finally and moved out. So it's a process that takes a long time. But there are certain key flashpoints we can identify here. 1948 is obviously a big one. 1964 is a big one. But it's a process that doesn't happen immediately. It's messy.